what is it you think Europe has failed to understand about the way the world is changing?
Well, I mean, I feel very sad for Europe. And by the way, I'm not an enemy of Europe. I mean, I'm a friend of Europe. And at the end of the day, geopolitics is one of the most cruel businesses in the world. It's absolutely cruel. And if you get it wrong, you really get yourself into a mess in terms of wars. And frankly, the Ukraine war was eminently avoidable. You know, in the 1990s, you go back and check some of the leading voices in the Western world, including, for example, George Kennan, the man who was the architect for United States victory in the Cold War. He said, why are you expanding NATO? You've got to humiliate Russia. And at some point in time, Russia will react. And then you say how evil the Russians are, how terrible the Russians are. George Kennan said this in an interview with Tom Friedman in 1999. And it's just plain common sense to everybody. And have you noticed one fact? The Europeans keep saying, hey, what the Russians are doing is terrible. They violated international law. We must impose sanctions on them. And they impose sanctions on Russia. And you know what? 85% of the world's population didn't impose sanctions on Russia. 85%. Now, what message does that send to Europe? It sends a message which the president of Brazil has sent. Hey, you cannot just blame Russia for this war. Ask yourself how you were responsible and what could you have done to prevent the war. And as you know, as lately as 2014, Henry Kissinger proposed a formula in the Washington Post saying, okay, you know, let's allow Ukraine to grow and develop as a sovereign country. Let's allow Ukraine to join the European Union, but let's give a commitment that Ukraine will never join NATO. And that commitment was never given. So there are many ways and means in which the war could have been avoided. But I can tell you, Henry Kissinger also told me privately, now he's passed away, I can say this, that the quality of mind of European leaders has gone down very badly. And they have no understanding of how the world has changed fundamentally and how the 12% of the world's population who live in the West can no longer impose their will on the rest. And that's what's happening. We are seeing the birth pangs of a new world order before our eyes.
And I suppose you would make the same argument about the rest of the world's attitudes towards China. But what does that mean for what Europe should be doing instead? You know, I mean, the fact is there is a war. You know, Russia continues to bomb Ukraine. Are you saying Europe should stop condemning Russia?
You know, diplomacy was invented 2,000 years ago, not to enable you to talk to your friends, because when you talk to your friends, they don't chop your heads off. But 2,000 years ago, as you know, kings used to regularly chop off the heads of envoys. And that's how the concept of diplomatic immunity came about. And the whole purpose of diplomacy is, how do you talk to your enemies? And what's striking about the West, especially since its big victory at the end of the Cold War, is they just decided, we're only going to talk to our friends. And if you're not like us, we won't talk to you. And amazingly, by the way, the one man who's broken this mold is President Trump. He, in his first term, agreed to talk to the president of North Korea, Kim Jong-un. And he's agreed to talk to the president of Syria, technically a terrorist. And amazingly, when he invited Putin to come to Alaska, the entire Anglo-Saxon media, the entire globally Western media, the European leaders erupted in outrage. How can he talk to an enemy? Excuse me. That's what diplomacy is about. You talk to your enemies. And the stupidest thing that the Europeans did was not to emulate President Trump and say, okay, President Trump, if you are going to talk to President Putin, we're going to talk to him too. And I can tell you, as someone who practiced diplomacy for 33 years, you cannot solve any problem unless the two sides sit down and talk to each other openly, candidly, and that's how you make progress towards solving problems. And at the end of the day, I do believe that both sides can agree that Ukraine should not be a bone of contention between Russia and Europe. Ukraine can become a bridge between Russia and Europe, and it can be done. And I want to tell you that in other parts of the world, you know, countries which are supposed to be enemies have come together. In when I was ambassador to the UN from 1984 to 89, I spent my 5 years there fighting the Vietnamese ambassador over Vietnam's occupation of Cambodia, 1984 to 89. You'd be surprised. After the Cold War ended, after Vietnam left Cambodia, Vietnam and Singapore became the best of friends, and Vietnam was admitted to ASEAN. It is Southeast Asia that is teaching the world how you overcome old disputes and divisions and come together in a pragmatic, sensible way.
But what about what the Ukrainians want? You know, they are under attack. They don't want to lose their territory. I mean, doesn't your prescription involve the rest of the world agreeing to carve up Ukraine at the expense of the people there?
Do you mind if I ask you a question?
Sure.
What is Europe doing about Gaza?
Well, right now it's not doing very much at all.
Nothing. Geopolitics is a cruel business. It's where power matters more than anything else. And if you want to help the people of Ukraine, you have to find a compromise formula that works for both sides. Okay? And that's the ultimate reality you have to deal with. And it's actually quite amazing that President Trump is the one who's being realistic on Ukraine and acknowledging that what Ukraine has lost on the battlefront, it cannot regain otherwise.
Because I think people in Europe look at Trump and they say, well, he's having all these meetings, but he doesn't achieve anything. And, you know, he keeps saying we're close to this and we're close to that, but we never really seem to be. You're saying actually he's on the right track.
Well, I think he's on the right track in trying to find a way to end the war. Whereas sadly, if you know, I mentioned to you that geopolitics is a cruel business. Just as in the Cold War, the United States wanted to fight the Soviet Union right down to the last Afghan. The rest of the world looks at what's happening in Ukraine, and we see that the Europeans want to fight the Russians right down to the last Ukrainian.
Right.
Geopolitics is a cynical business, absolutely cynical business. And it's very important, therefore, this is my advice to all small countries. Please be realistic. Be careful. There are great powers in the world. And if you live next to a great power, please don't go and stuff a stick into his eye because you will pay for the consequences. That's the reality of geopolitics.
That's pretty depressing for a lot of people, though, isn't it? I mean,
it's a fact of life. And incidentally, many of the failed states we see in the world today, whether it's Libya or Syria or to some extent Afghanistan and Iraq, these are the result of unnecessary Western interventions for which the West has never been held accountable. And I want you to know that the 88% of the world who live outside the West are not stupid. So when the West comes along and says, gosh, we are so saintly and virtuous, and the rest of the world, please become like us, we look at them and we see an emperor with no clothes.
Yeah, I mean, this is why I want to turn to China, because again, isn't this a relationship that Europe and America are potentially getting catastrophically wrong? You know, you have a world which is engaging with China and China investing in much of that world. And you have Europe and America that sees this as a threat and doesn't really know what kind of relationship to try and forge with China. What do you think it should be doing?
Well, I'm going to give away a huge secret. It is actually very easy to get along with China, because the Chinese, at the end of the day, are among the most pragmatic, rational, careful, calculating players on the world stage. You can sit down and make a deal with China as long as you understand and respect what their core interests are and what they clearly want to make sure they don't interfere in any way, for example, in their internal affairs. And then they say, okay, you don't interfere in my internal affairs, I won't interfere in your internal affairs, and let's find ways and means of getting along. And it's important to understand, I mean, everyone, the Western media demonizes China. I'll just give you a simple example. When China launches Belt and Road Initiative and said, okay, you want, let's work together to help build infrastructure in your countries, immediately the Anglo-Saxon media brilliantly said, oh, watch out, China is creating a debt trap for you, and if you're not careful, you'll be indebted to China and you'll be overtaken by China. I mean, for a start, that statement was an insult to the intelligence of the countries of the global south. They're so weak and stupid, they don't know what's good for them. But despite the massive Anglo-Saxon media campaign against the Belt and Road Initiative, over 145 countries applied to join the Belt and Road Initiative, showing basically that most of the world outside the West knows exactly how to get along with China. And by the way, this doesn't mean you kowtow to China, but you certainly you can work with China, and you treat it with respect, and the Chinese will treat you with respect. And the vast majority of countries in the world have no problems working with China.
But do you think there is a sort of a rivalry of civilization between China and the West? Or is that kind of irrelevant?
You know, I find it astonishing that Western minds expect that a civilization, which is the world's oldest continuous civilization, Chinese civilization, as it succeeds and modernizes, will become culturally a clone of the West. China will never become a replica of the West. And by the way, I'll give you another secret. Neither will India become a replica of the West. It may share some of the political structures of the West, but culturally, it is also not going to become a clone of the West. And I think the fundamental problem in the world today is that the Western mind cannot conceive of a world where you have many different successful, thriving civilizations living side by side, and they're not going to become like you. And I can also, by the way, give you a 100% guarantee that Islamic civilization will never become westernized. So at the end of the day, it's time for the Western mind to wake up and accept the new reality of a very different world in the 21st century.
Yes, but do you think these cultures can coexist, blend? You know, can we all get along economically while different aspects of our political and a non-political culture, you know, in some way sort of blend and overlap?
Let me give you some good news for a change. There is in the world a multi-civilizational laboratory. It's a part of the world where among 700 million people, there are 250 million Muslims, 150 million Christians, 150 million Buddhists, Mahayana Buddhists, Hinayana Buddhists, and you have Taoists, Confucianists, Hindus, and lots of communists too. And that part of the world is Southeast Asia. Now, if you really believe that all these religions and civilizations can't get along with each other, ASEAN or Southeast Asia should be seeing continuous conflict between the different cultures and civilizations. Instead, ASEAN has become an oasis of peace. Yeah, we have skirmishes from time to time between Thailand and Cambodia or the borders of Myanmar, but by and large, we have had no major wars in Southeast Asia. So I can tell you this, the Western mind has got to accept and treat other civilizations with respect rather than with condescension. And to stop believing that we reach the end of history, and that the rest of the world is going to become like the West, because if only Francis Fukuyama had changed one word in the title of his essay and called it the return of history, then he would have got it dead right.
Yes, I don't think even Fukuyama thinks the end of history was right now, does he? But you're sort of are you sort of painting over though the inevitable tensions that remain in the East, or are these things that will be ironed out as well? I mean, if you think about conflict between conflict in Cambodia, the Rohingya Muslims in Myanmar, ongoing conflict between China, India, and Pakistan. That flares up every so often over random bits of mountain territory. They're not getting everything right.
You're absolutely right. The world is sadly an imperfect place, and there will always continue to be problems, bilateral problems. But the question is, how do you manage them? And the big genius for most of Asia, leaving aside West Asia and the Middle East, is that there have been no major wars in East Asia. I mean, yes, there have been skirmishes within India and Pakistan, between Thailand and Cambodia, and then maybe between Philippines and China in the South China Sea, but no all-out war. And that's actually very, very important, because at the end of the day, among Asians, there is a very pragmatic culture which says, hey, we are different, but we have to get along. We'll treat each other with respect and find ways and means of getting along with each other. And that's why basically the Asian region is going dramatically. I mean, just to give you one statistic to illustrate how the world is changing, in the year 2000, when the 21st century opened, the entire GNP of the European Union combined was 8 times bigger than China. Today, they are about the same size. And by 2050, Europe will be half the size of China, right? These are the fundamental structural changes that are happening within Asia. And I think that's what we have to deal with, a very, very different world. And I would encourage, basically, and I know this is very difficult, I would encourage a little bit more humility by the Europeans. Because when you look at the statements made by Elizabeth von der Leyen, the head of European Commission, there's a head that made by Kaya Kallas, who's like the foreign minister of the European Union. They make these remarkably condescending statements about China. And the rest of the world looks at them with great astonishment and say, gosh, who do you think you are? How dare you make condescending statements about a civilization that is, 4,000 years old? And that's why you notice that the countries outside the West never repeat the kind of condescending statements that the West makes about China. So the problem doesn't lie out there, it lies with the West.
Do you think we're seeing a change, though? I mean, we recently saw Keir Starmer go to China, and there was much less of the trying to lecture China about human rights and political systems than we've seen in the past. And there's sort of an acceptance that China, you can't try to tell big countries how to live anymore. And I wonder what this means for democracy around the world and whether democracy is under threat.
Well, let me make 2 points. First, I want to emphasize I'm a friend of the United Kingdom. And when I was a young diplomat, I learned so much about diplomacy from my elderly British diplomatic friends because they taught me a lot. And Britain was known for its diplomatic finesse. But in the last 25 years, vis-à-vis China, UK has been vacillating from one extreme to the other, from Cameron and Osborne trying to beat a new path to China and build a new relationship, and then there comes along Boris Johnson and Liz Truss, and they make these remarkably condescending, dismissive statements about China. That was not what the UK was known for. So I think if you want to build on the recent visit by Sir Keir Starmer to Beijing, please at least have a certain level of consistency in your foreign policy towards China that will go beyond whether it's a Labour government or Conservative government or a Nigel Farage government hitting UK. Now, the second point I make is that democracy is not under threat at all. But China does not believe that either its political system or its culture is meant for export to the rest of the world. As you know, this is the exact opposite of the United States. The United States believes that anybody can be an American, and that's wonderful, frankly. Lots of people around the world, many good friends of mine, have gone to the United States and succeed. And that's a wonderful thing about American society. But if I, and I'm an ethnic Indian, if I go to China tomorrow and say, I want to be Chinese, the Chinese will look at me and say, what's wrong with this guy? He's not Chinese. And he cannot become Chinese. The Chinese are not trying to convert anybody at all. But what the Chinese have done is that clearly they have to, when they create a political system for China, the one big lesson that the Chinese people have learned after 4,000 years is that when you have chaos, everybody suffers. And when you have strong central government, everybody benefits. And from the Chinese people's point of view, the last 40 years of human and social development in China have been the best 40 years in 4,000 years of Chinese history. I know the Western media keeps asking, when are the Chinese people going to overthrow the Chinese Communist Party? And the Chinese people think, gosh, we must be very stupid if you're going to overthrow the Chinese Communist Party when our lives have improved so much. So that the legitimacy that the Chinese Communist Party enjoys in the eyes of the Chinese people is very strong and very real, even though they don't have a democracy. And by the way, if they do have a bad ruler who loses the mandate of heaven, Chinese history has also shown how they remove the empress.
I suppose what I mean is not so much the democracy is under threat from China, but democracy is under threat from itself. It's failing in all sorts of different countries. It is failing to change lives, and people are turning on traditional political structures. Old party systems are breaking down. So whether it's in America or Europe, the rise of populism, these are the threats to democracy that people perceive. And what you seem to be saying is, actually, this desire and thrust for strong government that can do the things that weak democracies struggle to do may be a good thing.
Well, I can tell you, you're absolutely right. Democracies are facing challenges, but I think you have to make it clear that the problem of democracy in the United States of America is very different from the problem of democracy, let's say, in the UK or in Europe. The fundamental problem in the United States is that it has become a plutocracy, and this is what Martin Wolf, Paul Volcker, Joseph Stiglitz have all said. And money, essentially, sadly, decides the ultimate public policy decisions in the United States of America. Now, that's a very deep structural problem in the United States, which the American people will have to sort out. Now, in the case of Europe, it is not true that money has overtaken European society, although I must say, if you want to know what's the metaphysical message of the Epstein files, the metaphysical message of the Epstein files is that the elites, political elites, business elites, big money elites, are very cozily tied to each other also, but not in the way of the United States. And so I think each society has got to examine what are the specific challenges to their democracy and deal with them. And I must emphasize also, like if you take Denmark, for example, frankly, there's nothing wrong with Denmark's democracy. It's functioning very well. Thank you very much. And if you look at Australia's democracy, nothing is wrong with Australia's democracy. And maybe one reason for that is that they have compulsory voting. So it is not the case that all democracies are failing, but democracy is not a silver bullet that can cure everything. Democracy actually is a wild animal. And when you ride that wild animal, you got to tame it. Because if you don't, you get all kinds of amazing things emerging in democratic polities. And by the way, the person who warned us about this happened to be Plato over 2,000 years ago.
So if you have a prescription for Europe, I mean, you've talked about the dangers of elites, of arrogance, of learning to understand that the world needs to be respected. But I think what I've also heard you talk about in the past is the weakness of European leadership, the quality of people in leadership roles, the quality of people in diplomacy. How do we get better people?
Well, that's a very good question. And I can tell you, I happen, it's a small historical point. I happened to accompany Mr. Lee Kuan Yew when he did his farewell tour, stepping down as PM in Europe. And I went with him and I happened to meet Helmut Kohl, happened to meet François Mitterrand, happened to meet Margaret Thatcher, heard her give a brilliant speech at number 10 Downing Street. I can tell you at that point in time during the Cold War, when Europe felt that it was under a real threat, they produced remarkable leaders. And I also became friends with Helmut Schmidt, for example, the former Chancellor of Germany. But that quality of mind of leaders no longer exists. And I think the Europeans need to engage in some deep reflection of where they have gone wrong. And they got to ask themselves, is it just simply the case? Just ensure that I have voting every 3, 4 years and everything we saw. Actually, no. You need a new level of honesty. And I tell you, there's one magical word that can solve Europe's problems. And that one magical word is sacrifice. You've got to tell the European populations, the French leaders have to tell the French people, you cannot retire at 55. The state cannot afford it. You cannot afford to work 35 hours a week. The state cannot afford it. These are hard realities. And the lesson we have learned in Asia is that if you tell people the truth and tell them we have to tighten our belts, and if you explain it to them well, they will come along with you. But if you pretend that you can keep on printing money and keep on increasing your national debt and not pay a long-term consequence of it, then you're basically driving your country over a cliff. And that's that the European leaders have not been honest with their populations. And so this belief that Europe can give as many subsidies as it wants to the common agricultural policy, oh, we can afford it. What's the problem? Now, all these crazy, reckless policies have to be stopped. And I think the people will understand it if everybody equally accepts a sacrifice.
I mean, when you say the quality of people no longer exists, are you saying that it will come because of hardship? Because at the moment, hardship is leading to populist leaders succeeding in European countries. Hardship and the failure of democratic governments is leading to people like Nigel Farage in this country. It's not leading to Margaret Thatcher or Helmut Kohl.
I think it to be fair to the people who are voting for these populist leaders, you have to acknowledge that it is a rational decision that they are making in voting for these populist leaders. So, for example, in 2016, in the contest between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, there comes along Hillary Clinton and says, "Hey, everything is fine. We're having a wonderful time. Vote for me and good times will roll on." And when she was told that people were supporting Trump, she called them a basket of deplorables. Now, she did not even acknowledge, Hillary Clinton, that the bottom 50% of the American population have seen their income stagnate for several decades. She never felt their pain. And so if these people who feel the pain see a leader who doesn't recognize their pain, what do? They vote for someone who's going to rock the boat. And that's why it was a very logical, rational decision to vote for Donald Trump, because they knew that he would go to Washington, D.C. and kick people over there. And similarly, if you feel that both the Labour and Conservative parties are out of touch with the people, then what do? You vote for Nigel Farage, not because you want him to be there ruling forever, but you want to kick the establishment and say, you're not listening to my pain. And that's how the populist leaders emerge. So when people blame the populace, the first question they should ask themselves is, well, how did we lay the political groundwork that led to the election of these populist leaders?
How would you change the world?
But my answer will surprise you, I think. One thing we need to do today urgently, which is to worship the United Nations. Because what's happening to our world is that it's shrinking dramatically, is becoming a small, interdependent global village. And the fact that you and I are speaking the way we are illustrates the fact we are in a global village. And if you're going to live in a global village without a village council, you're creating a prescription for disaster and chaos. So even though I know that the globally dominant Western media rubbishes the United Nations, frankly, if you want to find a trusted meeting place for 8 billion people on planet Earth, there's only one place they trust: the United Nations.
But isn't it actually the great powers that are undermining the United Nations? Donald Trump is doing everything he can to weaken it. He set up a rival body, the Board of Peace. Russia and China use their vetoes on the Permanent Five, strategically, that often stop the United Nations being effective. It is the small and medium-sized powers who want the United Nations to work, but the big powers are kind of making it fail.
Well, I can tell you, as someone who served on the United Nations Security Council for 2 years, about 20 years ago, I can tell you that in theory, the UN Security Council has got 15 members. In reality, there's five members, the five permanent members: US, China, Russia, United Kingdom, and France, and the 10 of us are observers.
When, the P5 and people who aren't in the P5 but who want to be like India, do not appear to be trying to shore up this village council, global village council, as you call it. How do you save it? How do you make it matter?
Well, I think, frankly, there are 193 states in the world. That's the first fact. 193 member states. And the vast majority of them, by the way, want to see a stronger and more effective United Nations. By 2050, India's economy will be four times bigger than UK. And if in 2050, UK has a permanent seat in the Security Council and India doesn't, then clearly the UN Security Council hasn't kept up with the world. And I can tell you, the founding fathers of the UN, and I've read the history of the UN, wanted to entrench the great powers of today in the UN, not the great powers of yesterday.
Kishore Mahbubani, thank you very much indeed. Thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.